Shrink Wrap Radio number 365, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques with John Fredrickson.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with John Fredrickson, MSW, about his 2013 book, Co-Creating Change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. John Fredrickson, MSW, is co-chair of the Intensive Short-Term Dynamic Psychotherapy Training Program at the Washington School of Psychiatry and treasurer of the International Experiential Dynamic Therapy Association. John is also co-chair of the ISTDP training program hosted by the United Kingdom ISTDP Society, London, England, and chair of the ISTDP training program hosted by the Norwegian ISTDP Society, Drammen, Norway. John also provides ISTDP training in Denmark, Poland, Italy, and the U.S. He's the author of over 20 published papers and a book, Psychodynamic Psychotherapy, Learning to Listen from Multiple Perspectives, as well as his previously mentioned 2013 book, Co-Creating Change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. So now, here's the interview. John Fredrickson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
Maybe I should say welcome back. You haven't actually been on Shrink Wrap Radio before, but it's good to have the opportunity to speak with you again after our 2009 interview on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com. So I don't think you'll notice any difference.
No, it's great to be back, and I look forward to having a chance to talk about my new book, Co-Creating Change.
Yes. And it's also good to be able to compliment you on that latest book, which in my opinion is a real tour de force.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate hearing that.
Yeah, well, I really mean it. Now, I recall from our previous interview that you're one of the foremost practitioners in the United States of an approach known as experiential dynamic psychotherapy. I also recall that it is a relatively short-term approach. So in as much as we may have many listeners who've not heard that 2009 interview, maybe you can give us a bit of an overview on the history and theory of that approach.
Sure. Well, you know, the idea of experiential dynamic therapy is an understanding that we all have things that we want in life and that our desires trigger feelings. And based on our past, sometimes those feelings will trigger anxiety. And one way we deal with anxiety and those feelings is to use defenses as a way to ward off feelings and anxiety. And in a way, this should be seen really quite apparent to any kind of listener, is that in life, we have things we want, and oftentimes we find that pursuing the things we want makes us anxious, and then we find ourselves engaging in, you know, maladaptive behaviors that keep us from pursuing our desires as effectively as we might. And those maladaptive behaviors we call defenses. So in an experiential dynamic therapy, we're trying to help people see those maladaptive behaviors that get in their ways and help them face what makes them anxious and face the feelings underneath that have been warded off so they can channel those feelings into effective action rather than use these maladaptive behaviors that sabotage their efforts. And experiential dynamic therapy really comes from the whole tradition of psychodynamic therapy that's based on this idea. The difference being is that many times dynamic therapy devolved into a kind of a form of explain to patients about why they did things, the idea that interpretation would somehow lead to change. But that over time, we found that interpretation oftentimes may lead to intellectual insight, but not to any genuine experiential change. Mm-hmm. And this led to, within the interpersonal tradition, they came up with the idea of the experiential insight. The idea that when you have an insight, it's really not only just a cognitive, but it's also an emotional insight, an insight really into yourself and a felt experience.
Right.
So, So experiential dynamic therapy is really designed to operate in a more time-efficient way by avoiding the dangers of intellectualization and focusing much more on helping patients not only become aware of their feelings, but feel them and face the kinds of feelings they tend to avoid.
Now, you must have given that explanation before because it was very smooth. And you really covered a lot of ground. There's so much ground to be covered. Now, I noticed that in our previous interview and just now as you were speaking about it, that you refer to it as experiential dynamic psychotherapy, but also noticed that the subtitle of the book is effective dynamic therapy techniques. And so I was wondering, in as much as effective seems to have replaced the word experiential, does that indicate any shift in your thinking?
No, it doesn't reflect a shift. You know, the title was, that use of that word effective was really more for marketing.
Yeah.
You know, let's face it, as therapists, you know, we've read lots of books. We've heard lots of theories. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether you're a CBT therapist, a Gestalt therapist, a body therapist, you know, an analyst. It doesn't matter who you are. We just want to be effective.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I like about this book, is that you acknowledge contributions from other major approaches of the day, such as you just did, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, emotion-focused therapy, psychoanalysis, body work, and mindfulness approaches. Is this an instance of the blind man and the elephant, each seizing upon a different aspect of the beast and thinking they have the whole picture?
I truly think so. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, psychotherapy is an incredibly young field. It's only about 120 years old. I mean, you know, I just think what's going to happen in therapy over the next 20 and 50 years is going to be just incredible because we're just at the very beginning of understanding things. We all know, like, we've got this diagnostic and statistical manual that came out that's just a disaster. Now, I don't fault the people who made it. It's just, that's where our field is at this point. We don't have a lot of agreement on fundamental things. Mm-hmm. And so for my feeling, you know, when you look at behavior therapy, you look at cognitive therapy, you look at Gestalt therapy, each of these approaches does a lot of good. They have fantastic techniques, and I always encourage my students, read all these people because there's some great techniques out there that everyone should know, at least in my opinion. My hope was that I could write a book that would show how these different techniques could fit together within a system so that we would see how these parts, like you say, how these parts could fit into a whole. Because there's a, you know, every technique, I'm sure you've run into this too, every technique works until it doesn't.
Yeah. And I share that perspective with you. That's one of the things I like about your work. I was also struck that you start off in the very first chapter with a reference to Buddhism and the role of suffering. Mm-hmm. Are you a Buddhist or a meditator yourself?
I am a meditator. I wouldn't call myself a Buddhist, but I certainly have been a meditator for many years. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I do think, and the reason I brought that up is that, you know, we have to have sort of, I felt the book needed to start with a kind of basic understanding of what do we mean by pain versus suffering. You know, there's the pain of everyday life, you know, that everyone we love, we will lose either through death or through loss in some other way. And that's true of every possession we have. Everything we have, we will lose. And that's the pain of life. But then there's suffering, which is an option. You know, suffering is, pain is created by life, but suffering is what's created by our defenses. So it was a really attempt to kind of really help understand the wisdom of Buddhism and the place of it, but then also understand the suffering that's called by our defenses that us therapists can really focus on.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting opener and a nice compact way to kind of get into the topic. And it was from that place that you then went on to talk about, you know, how cognitive behavioral therapy conceptualizes suffering as mm-hmm. the thoughts that mm-hmm. we have, maladaptive thoughts and beliefs. And so you went through each of those approaches or several of them, kind of showing how they had their own way of looking at the elephant, so to speak.
Exactly. And that they each have their own wisdom. I think that one of the dangers in our field is the attempt to have one approach that says, well, this is good and something else is bad. Each of these approaches has very important pieces of wisdom that we ignore at our peril.
Yeah, I'm remembering The Primal Scream by Arthur Janov years ago. And the title of his book was The Cure for Neuroses.
Yes, if only it were so.
Yeah, the one way.
Carpenter saying, screwdriver, the solution to all carpentry problems.
Right. Now, you also refer to some of the major theorists in neuroscience today. Mm-hmm. And for the last couple of years, I've had the sense that the separate and conflicting schools of therapy are going away, and that at least in terms of practice, we may be headed towards more of a consensus. And I wanted to ask you, do you sense anything like this? But I think you actually said something just a little bit ago that suggests that you do.
Absolutely. You see this all over the place. You know, there used to be such a schism between psychoanalytic thinking and cognitive behavioral thought. And yet when we look, say, like Jeffrey Young's schema-based therapy, what are schemas? They're ways to think about transference. I mean, because the fact is people have repetitive ways of interacting with people, and the cognitive behavioral therapists began running into this, and they realized, wow, we have to figure out a way to understand these things. They don't call it transference. They call them schemas, but they're basically dealing with the same problem. You see it in behavior therapy. I forget the group that's out in Seattle, but they do some beautiful work in behavior therapy where, again, they're really looking at moment-to-moment relational behaviors where they're dismantling certain kinds of transference patterns that could mess up relationships. Even within psychoanalysis, you see a tremendous welcoming of a body therapy. You know, they're really revisiting the body and the work of Wilhelm Reich, and they're very interested now in the work of Pat Ogden.
Wow, fascinating. Now, you know, with all this new understanding emerging out of neuroscience and brain research, do you think it's simply describing what we already know but at the level of the brain, or that it's potentially guiding and refining talk therapy? In other words, is it merely window dressing, or is it suggesting ways in which our therapeutic interventions can maybe be more effective?
Well, there's obviously dialogue that does some of both. Right now, our understanding of neuroscience is really so limited that we really can't make really direct references to psychotherapy in large part because our understanding of neuroscience is still so limited. Certainly our understanding of neuroscience heightens our awareness of understanding anxiety and anxiety regulation, and in that sense is very, very important. I think neuroscience also allows us to understand defenses as forms of habit that, you know, under Hebb's law, the idea that neurons that fire together wire together, and it helps you understand to a certain degree, there may be to a certain degree, a neurological basis for certain defenses being so rigid and why they need to be interrupted so rapidly and repetitively biased precisely to interrupt a particular neural pattern. So if, in that sense, that can lead us to a different rationale for a more active technique in certain situations. At the same time, you know, Damasio has been very good to point out that we mustn't try to localize brain function so much in one area of the brain, because then we end up with almost a modern-day form of phrenology. Remember where they said, well, you could tell by bumps on the head where certain psychological functions happened. And sometimes we're reading things where people were saying, well, you know, such and such capacity can be found in the anterior cingulate cortex. And in fact, as Damasio is careful to point out, almost no brain function is strictly localized. It's an emergent that arises out of the complex interaction of multiple brain systems. And so for that reason, I think we'll learn a lot coming down the road, but we have to be careful not to use neuroscience to be overly simplistic.
That's a good caution, I think, and really well stated. Now, another thing that I really like about your book is that it does such a good job of kind of giving a roadmap in doing therapy, because it really helps to kind of know what you're up to, where you're going, what the goal is, where to start, etc. One of the things that you talk about is the you know, is the therapeutic task. What do you see as the task of the therapist, and what do you see as the task of the client?
That's a really good question, because I think that, you know, one of the reasons that therapy oftentimes doesn't work is the patient's not really sure what their job is. You know, none of us wants to be in the position where the patient comes in after a couple of months and says, well, I've been talking, I've been saying what comes to mind, how come I'm not better yet? You know, mm-hmm. because a person can say what comes to mind at the bar.
right.
and oftentimes do, but it doesn't lead to psychological insight. So it's very important for us to be clear what the therapeutic task is so that, to be fair to the patient, that they know what their job is to do. Otherwise, they mistakenly will think they just need to say what comes to mind and are going to hope that magic happens. So for me, really what's important for us is to work together with the patient to first find out what their problem is. And once we find out what the problem is, to then explore that problem so that we can find out what feelings the patient is struggling with, how anxiety is discharged in the body, what defenses they're using during the session. And then with that understanding, then we can get kind of a consensus with a patient about their problem. Because a big thing, too, is we need to have a clear consensus on what the problem is and a consensus then on what causes the problem. Because only with a consensus on what causes the problem can we get consensus on what to do about it. So once we have a sense of the feelings, anxiety, and the defenses the patient is using in session, and we help them see those defenses, then we can get consensus on the problem. Say, well, I notice you've got this problem, and I notice we talk about this. You mentioned you're having trouble with this feeling. It makes you anxious. You get tensed up. And we notice that you're saying when you have this feeling, let's suppose it's with a husband, and when you're angry with your husband, we're noticing you tend to turn the anger on yourself. And do you think that could be making you depressed? And then you have a tendency to kind of criticize yourself rather than let yourself be critical of your husband, right? And then you tend to, one way you deal with your anger is to kind of doubt yourself. And do you think that could be part of what makes you kind of confused, where you feel like you don't know which way to go? And if you have that consensus on what the defenses are that they're using and how those defenses are creating the presenting problems, then you can say, so then our task here, if you like, would be for us to see if we can help you overcome the self-attack, the self-criticism, and the self-doubt. So we can help you get clear, help you become more assertive, and then help you face this anger here in the room that's towards your husband. So we can help you channel it into clarity and more effective self-assertion rather than have it get turned into this depression and confusion. Does that make sense to you?
That's a great example. And you keep using the word consensus, which kind of, I guess, echoes the title of the book, Co-Creating Change. And so I think that's a way of getting across the idea of consensus. And it suggests something else that you discuss, which is the therapeutic alliance. Mm-hmm. And many therapists will recognize that phrase. Tell us about your view of the therapeutic alliance and how one goes about creating it. I mean, the way you described it, it sounded like everything flowed very nicely, but sometimes actual therapy sessions are a little different than our models.
Oh, well, this was, of course, of an ideal heuristic, of course.
Sure.
It took place in 30 seconds, but it could take an hour, several hours to really develop a consensus. Because let's face it, as we explore the patient will almost never sees the defenses that create the presenting problems. And so that requires very sensitive work on us helping them see certain mechanisms that are happening automatically that are causing their suffering. You know, patients don't walk into the room saying, boy, do I want to suffer today.
Right.
Patients are just using certain automatic mechanisms of which they're unaware, and those mechanisms are creating the suffering. So our job is really to work very carefully with them so they can learn and see these mechanisms in the moment, in the session, moment by moment, so they learn to see what's been creating their suffering. So the alliance really is developing a consensus on a problem and a consensus on what's causing the problem, and then this consensus on what we're going to do here to tackle that problem, and making sure that it's the patient's will to engage in this task. Because you may have a patient who says it's not his will. You know, I'll never forget the patient who walked into my office, and I said, what's the problem you'd like me to help you with? And he says, well, I don't want to effing depend on you. You know, now at that point, you know, we obviously have some alliance building to do.
Right, right.
Because this is a man who's coming in with a defiant transference. So we really have to build a consensus on the problem, what's causing it, and the task that's going to do it. And that's the conscious therapeutic alliance. And in fact, it's something we're working on all the time. Because as soon as a patient agrees to look at something and he's looking at something that's difficult, he may say, well, I'm not so sure I feel comfortable. I'm not sure I want to. And at that point, you say, well, I have no right to ask you to look at anything you don't want to look at. I'm not sure I'm ready yet. How long would you like to wait?
So somehow it's really important to build a relationship and to communicate both verbally and nonverbally that you're on their side.
Absolutely.
And that you want to work together, that you expect it to be a collaborative endeavor.
Absolutely. And that it's our collaboration forming forces together against these mechanisms that have been getting in their way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember a patient saying, well, I don't feel I'm ready yet. And I says, well, how long would you like to wait? And he says, well, I've been waiting 13 years. And I say, do you feel a need to wait longer before you avail yourself of my help? He says, no, I think I'm ready to go. But it's very important to realize that the therapist is not the driver of the process. We're the servant of the patient's will. So, and this does a lot because patients oftentimes want to oppose therapy or they take a passive stance, which is just going to defeat them. And so it's not our task to kind of be the driver of the therapy, but let the patient's will be the drive.
Yeah, typically somebody who is not particularly, quote, psychologically minded or hasn't been in therapy before, mm-hmm. they're hoping for the silver bullet and they're yeah. likely to come in and be pretty passive.
Yeah. And so it's really, really important to dispel any notions about silver bullets or magic actions. Yes, if I had a magic wand, I would wave it over you, but it doesn't appear to be I've been granted those wishes. Now, we're talking about conscious therapeutic alliance, but in this model, we also have another dimension is that we think about the unconscious therapeutic alliance, meaning that we have a belief that every patient underneath really does want to become well. And the reason that becomes important is that oftentimes when you're dealing with especially resistant patients, we may not see any evidence of a conscious therapeutic mm-hmm. alliance, right? We might just see someone who comes across as really stubborn or defiant, and we think, oh my gosh, there's nothing to deal with. But oftentimes what we find is that with these very resistant patients, that we find that there's a part of the patient in the room that's actually trying to get better, even though the patient is not aware of it and wouldn't admit to it. And we'll see signs of that. And I think it's important to realize that we look at these defenses in a resistant part of patient, but there's also an unconscious yearning to overcome these problems, an unconscious wish to become well. And the importance of remembering that no matter how resistant or sick the patient is, we operate with an underlying assumption that there's always some part of the patient that does want to overcome their suffering.
Would you point that out in the moment when you saw little evidences of that or not?
It depends on the level of resistance of the patient. There was a beautiful case I heard about just today where a patient began in his initial session with the therapist, and his presentation is kind of jumbly, and then he suddenly reveals that he had made a suicide attempt. And of course, the therapist is quite anxious. But another patient could have mentioned that he had a suicide attempt and just gone on and into the details of the gun he had or how he wished he'd done it. This guy, he said that he killed himself, and the very next thing he said is, my wife died a year ago. Now, that's very interesting. And at that point, you could talk about his suicidality. You could say, this guy needs to talk about the death of his wife.
Yeah.
And that's where we needed to go.
Yes.
Another person could have really gotten tangled up and says, oh, I better check on, whether his will, his intent, and, risk management. But as I said to her, you have a whole couple hours to assess that. But at this moment, this guy gave you a gift, and you need to pick that up. Because it's true he's suicidal, and we've got to talk about that later. But first, we've got to form a relationship with the person who has this problem.
Yeah, I hear the supervisor in you now giving feedback to that person.
Yeah. This is a more, we get caught up in the suicidality rather than realize this is a way to deal with suffering. If we can get in contact with this suffering and reduce that, the symptoms will take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier we noted that CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, focuses on thoughts and beliefs, and body therapy focuses on the body. Your therapeutic focus is on feelings. You've mentioned them a couple of times here. What's the rationale for that? Why do you think feelings should be the primary thing?
Well, it's several things. One is that from this point of view, it's feelings that trigger anxiety, and that anxiety trigger the defenses that create the patient's presenting problems and symptoms. Now, and so for instance, let's suppose we're talking about this depressed woman. She's angry at her husband for some reason and gets her anxious. She might have a lot of self-critical thoughts that the cognitive therapist would very correctly bring out, you know, the maladaptive cognitions. Oh, I'm an idiot. I never get things right. I'm so stupid. In other words, we'd see the maladaptive mechanisms of globalization and so on that the cognitive therapist talk about. Now, the cognitive therapist also point out how this will trigger anxiety. They're absolutely right. From our point of view, though, causality starts earlier, that there's feelings that trigger anxiety. And these maladaptive thoughts, from our point of view, are actually defenses. They're ways of turning anger against herself. And so they will make her depressed, and they will also accelerate anxiety. So like any good cognitive therapist, we'll address those thoughts. We'll interrupt them right away because by interrupting those thoughts and helping the patient see those thoughts are what we call defenses. We can interrupt the turning of anger on the self, and we can interrupt the sequence of anxiety. Then we would do one extra piece and say, okay, let's see if we can help her face those underlying feelings. Then she won't have to use those maladaptive thoughts and defenses. The body work for us is very complex because we want the patient to experience their feelings as deeply as possible in the body, because the more deeply they feel it, the more they can harness their feelings in adaptive ways. And also another way that the body is really important is that we look at anxiety as a biophysiological phenomenon that's discharged in the somatic nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. So somatic nervous system is any muscle you can voluntarily tense up would be your somatic nervous system. Now, when anxiety goes into those muscles and the patient tenses up, they can face their feelings readily. But when we see a patient who's not tense, then we're going to look to see if the anxiety is getting discharged into the autonomic nervous system. So what, in other words, do they have sick to the stomach? Do they get nausea? Do they have diarrhea? Do they have problems thinking? Do they have migraines? All these kinds of physical symptoms let us know, wow, their anxiety is way too high. And then we're going to attune to the patient's body very carefully because we want to make sure that anxiety is at an optimal level for learning. If it's too low, we're obviously not exploring anything important. But if it's too high, it's dangerous to the patient physiologically. And it also interferes with new learning. So that's how we integrate the body work, is in the experience of feeling and in the regulation of anxiety.
That's fascinating. Now, you're not doing any body manipulation, are you, in your approach?
No.
It's not a hands-on.
No.
It's more a careful being aware of.
But the fact is, if someone who's a body worker, they could use my book and understand conflict in a new way, and they could incorporate all their bodily interventions as ways, because there are certain body worker interventions that are great for dealing with defenses. You know, look, Ron Kurtz, you know, in his form of body work, Hakomi, one of his most important interventions is a patient would want to avoid something, and they'd want to push against something. So he'd encourage them to push against it, or someone would push against it for them, which would then would release them from having to use the defense. Right? So in psychoanalysis, that'd be called reinforcing the defense so that the patient feels safe to reveal something.
Yeah.
You know, you can do that verbally, or a body worker can do it bodily. Same purpose.
Okay. I would think that most people would regard anxiety as a feeling, but you talk about anxiety as the first detour from feelings. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, obviously, anxiety is a feeling, but it's unique because it has a function unlike any other feeling, because it has the function of signaling danger. And so in that way, I just differentiate anxiety from the other feelings because it has a unique feeling. You know, anger is like somebody's gotten in your way. Happiness, it's a great day. Sadness, it's loss, right? So we have these basic feelings that we know about from Ekman and the emotion researchers. But everyone agrees that anxiety is unique because of its function. And, of course, we know from the work of Steve Porges, it's had this function throughout evolution, right, where Steve yes. Porges looks at it, you know, the way this anxiety gets discharged in the reptiles and then the mammals and then here in the human. And so in this approach, we're really looking at those different discharge patterns of anxiety that Porges talks about here within the human.
Yeah, yeah. The phrases, how do you feel about that, and how does that make you feel, have become almost hackneyed, especially as portrayed on TV and in the movies. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah, how does a therapist move beyond those repetitive formulations?
Well, one way is to really get clear about whether they're asking about feeling. You know, if you ask somebody, what do you feel about that? You're actually inviting the person to intellectualize. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be much more effective to say, so what, you know, let's suppose a boyfriend had been very insulting to your patient. And you would, so rather than say, how do you feel about that? You might say, so what's the feeling toward him for insulting you like that? So you may ask a more specific question. You could also ask, I noticed that when you talk about your boyfriend, you seem to get very anxious. Do you have any sense what the feeling is toward him that's making you so anxious? So in these ways, it helps patients to tease apart feeling and anxiety. A patient might say, well, I just feel really tense. And you say, exactly. And that tension is a sign of your anxiety. So let's see if we can separate your feeling from anxiety and find out what's the feeling toward your boyfriend for doing that. That makes you so tense. Could we take a look at the feeling underneath the anxiety?
Do you ever direct them to their body to ask, you know, where in your body are you feeling that?
Absolutely. I do that once they can name it. Once they can say, oh, I'm angry or I'm sad, then I might say, where do you notice feeling that in your body? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes people have trouble actually labeling the feeling. They have defenses against labeling it. So we just work with that initially. We don't jump any steps. We just try to go very carefully. What is that feeling? And once they can say what the word is and they can label the feeling, then we'll ask, how do you experience that physically in your body? Usually, we'll see some defenses against paying attention to feelings in body, because oftentimes patients come from backgrounds where those feelings were verboten and where they were supposed to ignore rather than pay attention to their feelings. So we may have to spend some time helping them pay attention to that feeling so they know actually how they experience it inside. And then they begin to see what are these automatic defenses they've been using that prevent them from knowing what they're feeling.
Great. Now, I wonder if you're going back to neuroscience, I wonder if you're familiar with the work of Bruce Ecker, whose coherence therapy also focuses on feelings and it draws upon the work of Joseph Ledoux, who Ecker believes that during intense emotion, there's a window of opportunity to reprogram painful memories. Are you familiar with his work? I think I see some parallels.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, both of his books, very nice books. And he's done a really great service, I think, in his second book in particular by
yes.
bringing in Ledoux's work and this idea that there's that window and a period of emotional consolidation. And I agree with that completely. But the thing is, for most of us therapists, it's such darn hard work to get to that moment where that reconsolidation can happen. And so my work is really focusing primarily on how do we help to get that alliance? How do we help the patient regulate their anxiety? How do we help them see and let go of these defenses so they can build the capacity to bear the feelings and then get to that transformation moment? So I have a lot of respect for his book. It's just that I think for many of our patients, we have so much preparatory work we have to do to get to that moment where the transformation can happen.
Yeah, I'm sure he would agree with you too. You talk about defenses as the second detour from feelings, anxiety being the first and defenses being the second. But many of us were taught to never attack the defenses from a psychoanalytic point of view at any rate. So if they're a detour, how do you recommend working with them that's not attacking?
Well, I would agree, never attack a defense. And what is a defense? A defense is just simply a way a patient deals with a feeling. So, in fact, it's really a behavior. So we have no right to attack any patient, and there's no way we could attack a patient's behavior. Really, the only person who can do anything about the patient's behavior is the patient. So actually, what we have to do first is help the patient see a behavior that they haven't seen before. You know, a patient might think she's stupid. She doesn't realize that she's criticizing herself. So could that be a form of self-criticism? Could that be hurting you, do you think? So we would identify for the patient the behavior. Can she see it? Can she see that this behavior might be hurting her? And we would never criticize her for it. We'd say, look, you didn't do this intentionally. It sounds like this happens automatically. Would that be fair to say? Would you like my help in identifying these automatisms so that you could be in control of your life instead of those automatisms taking the control away from you? And that way we do three things. We help the patient see the defense, we help them see the price, and we help the patients feel separate from that behavior so that the next time that defense comes up, she could see it and then make a choice to use that defense or make a choice to face whatever feelings come up instead.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never a matter of attacking the defense, but really in a stepwise manner, helping the patient see these mechanisms so the patient has a fighting chance to grapple with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you distinguish between two kinds of defenses that you call tactical and repressive. What's the difference between those two?
Well, actually, I talk about four different kinds of defenses.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, well, I talk about tactical defenses, which are just tactics to keep you at a distance. They're what we might call interpersonal defenses. So they're really just designed to keep you at a distance. A repressive defense is designed to just keep a feeling at a distance. So I might really be trying to relate to you, but you'd be asking me about my anger and says, and you'd see me trying to tell you, but these defenses come up, but you can see I'm really trying. Whereas another person might have his legs crossed and his arms behind his head, you know, and he's keeping you on a need-to-know basis, as they would say in the CIA. Then I also talk about regressive defenses, where these are kinds of defenses where we see that there's a regression in the patient's ability to see reality. You know, these are defenses like, you know, when you see projection and the patient really loses a realistic grasp of who you are and what you're trying to do. And so my book then talks about how to deal with defenses like projection and how to reestablish reality testing in the session so the patient can actually have an alliance with you rather than a misalliance with a projection. And then there's a fourth kind of defense, which I think is a very interesting one. It was first brought up by Wilhelm Reich. It's what we call a character defense. And it's a very interesting one. It's if a patient comes from, say, a dismissive family, then when he talks about his own feelings, he will tend to be dismissing his feelings and dismissing himself. So it's actually what we call a character defense is a patient does to himself what someone did to him in the past.
Okay.
They may dismiss their feelings, they may be very abusive with themselves, but they'll really be enacting. So transference is where someone does to you what someone did in the past, and a character defense is where a patient does to himself what someone did in the past.
Uh-huh. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you introduce another term that I think is a little bit unique, psychodiagnosis for creating an effective focus. What do you mean by psychodiagnosis in the context of the therapeutic session?
Thanks so much for asking that. You know, we have this weird thing today is that we start work with a patient, we're supposed to do a diagnosis, right? And so we go to the DSM-4, now it'll be the 5, and we have to come up with a certain number. And really what that is what we call a phenomenological diagnosis. It's basically a list of the symptoms the patient has. Okay. Now, the problem is any of a number of things could call as a cause of symptoms. So although we have a diagnosis, according to DSM-5, we still have no idea how to treat the patient.
Right.
We simply have symptoms. We don't know what causes them. See, that's very different. You know, I recently had a biopsy done, and they discovered, well, I had cancer. Okay. So now that's a diagnosis, right? And so then I had surgery, and thankfully they were able to get rid of my cancer. Now that's a diagnosis. You see something, a high PSA score, they do the test, they know, okay, this is, it's cancer, we're going to treat it. That's different. Here, and so what we do in psychodiagnosis, we find out what are the symptoms the patient has. In other words, what's his presenting problem? Then we do one more step. Then we say, okay, can we take a look at a specific example where this problem comes up? And as we assess in the session, the patient comes anxious in the session, and we assess where is his anxiety discharged in the body, and we assess moment by moment.
Part of the subtitle of your book is Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. Now, the word techniques might strike some people as wrong, as manipulative, but you have an interesting take on the word technique in relation to psychotherapy. Tell us about that, if you will.
Absolutely. You know, when we think about techniques, we oftentimes think about it as a way to manipulate an object, right? It's like you can have a technique of using a chisel to carve a piece of wood for a sculpture. But when it comes to therapy, we're not really here to manipulate anyone. The fact is the patient's life is really manipulated by their defenses. And we're trying to help them see the defenses that manipulate them so they can regain their freedom of choice. So what we call really techniques in psychotherapy, they're not attempts to manipulate the patient. They're actually new ways and more effective ways to relate to the patient. So we can say we have the technique of exploring feeling, asking, so what was your feeling towards him for hitting you? Now, in a way, we could call it a technique, but it's really a way of relating to the patient on a deeper level. You know, if a patient says, well, I just feel like giving up and letting you just take control, you say, yeah, but, you know, I can't really do this by myself. You know, you can't do this without me, but actually I can't do this without your will. And that's why we have to find out if this is something you want for yourself. Not in a way we could look at it as a technique, but for me, I really look at it as a way of relating to the patient. And it's a way of relating to the patient in a way that's very respectful, you know, that we have to be equal partners in this. So that what I think it's useful for us to step back, it's not to manipulate or change or trick a patient. It's really finding healthy and more expansive ways of relating to patients. And when patients are trying to relate to us in habitual ways that will harm a relationship, how to find ways we can relate to a patient that get them out of dead-end ways of relating that are hurting them.
Yeah, I understand that. And at the same time, I think this book is just so helpful, particularly for people who are starting out as therapists, and they need some, quote, techniques. They need some guidance, some models to know what to respond to and where to go if the patient does this or that. And so I think your book is really rich in providing that kind of guidance on the one hand and in communicating the kind of respectful considerations that you've just spoken about.
Thanks so much. Yeah, my feeling is no matter what theoretical perspective someone comes from, you know, we're all trying to heal patients. And we all are dealing with patients who get too anxious. We're all dealing with patients who have pathological ways of relating. We're all dealing with patients who have maladaptive behaviors. And we all need to know how to deal with those phenomena, regardless of our theoretical perspective. So my hope is that this would be a book that would appeal to anyone from any theoretical perspective, because it would be providing them a whole series of solutions for problems that occur across the whole spectrum of patients, and that since it had all these transcripts of actual patient sessions, people would really see in vivo, how do we work, how do we address certain problems, how do we speak, how do we respond. So it would be really a practical, hands-on book. And I have to say that, yes, I know it'll be helpful to beginning therapists, but I have to say as an experienced therapist myself, I'm always so grateful when I hear a phrase or a kind of approach from some colleague. It's like, oh, I never thought of saying that. That would be so helpful. You know, I think at every stage of our career, we're looking for new things that could help our patients.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree, both on the need for it and the fact that I think your book is useful for experienced people as well. Now, another practical consideration that you raise is building the self-observing capacity in clients, which is a pretty key ingredient in successful therapy. How do you go about building that self-observing capacity?
That's a great question. You know, it goes all the way back to Freud, right, when he talks about the observing ego, all the way up to today when we talk about mindfulness approaches. Because what are we talking about? The ability to observe ourselves moment by moment by moment. And I think of this as really kind of a mindfulness approach in the sense that we're really paying attention moment by moment by moment. You know, if a patient is not able to observe their anxiety, they can't regulate it. So a lot of our work may be helping a patient notice a symptom of anxiety and labeling it as anxiety so they can pay attention to anxiety. And once they can see that anxiety, noticing what was a feeling just before that made them anxious. Or when they're dealing with feelings, to notice in the session when they use a particular defense, when they happen to dismiss a feeling. You know, you might ask a patient, so what's a feeling towards your boyfriend for hitting you? Well, it was no big deal, right? Well, do you notice how you dismiss yourself? When you dismiss yourself, could that be possibly inviting him to dismiss you too? Would that be something that you would like me to help you with, right? Mm-hmm. Now the patient's, wow, I hadn't realized I dismissed myself. Gee, yeah, I don't want to invite my boyfriend to dismiss me. You know, so in that way, we help the patient not just observe a defense, but observe it when they use it. Because if they can learn to observe a defense when they use it, that's the moment when they actually have free choice.
Okay, is this self-observing capacity what people mean when they talk about psychological mindedness, or is it different than that?
Absolutely, yeah, because what does that mean, psychological mindedness? It's we're really trying to develop within people an ability to see that when they have a feeling, they get anxious and they use defenses. We're trying to develop an ability that they can see how defenses create their presenting problems. We're trying to develop a sense of causality, you know, which is we take straight from behavior therapy, right? Wow, we see when you have this feeling with your husband, you get anxious, you use this strategy, and then it's getting you depressed. See, if a patient can see causality and they see the defense hurts them, they realize, wow, I need to let go of this defense and face what's underneath. At the same time, part of this is also helping people see that they're not the same as their defense. This is a huge piece. You know, I talk to a patient, he says, well, you say, do you notice how you detach? And he says, well, that's just the way I am. I'm a detached guy.
Yeah.
Right? And then we have to say, no, it's not the way you are, but it is a way you deal with your feelings. You detach. Mm-hmm. At that point, then we separate the patient from a particular choice he makes about how he feelings. Or we might even have to go farther and say, actually, this detachment has as little to do with you as a vine has to do with a tree. And we have to pull this vine of detachment. We have to pull this vine of self-criticism off of you so we can find out who you really are underneath.
Oh, I like that metaphor.
Yeah, because these defenses are not the person. They're just, they're like an ugly garment that covers up who the person really is underneath. But all of what we call psychological mindedness is really these specific self-observing capacities. Because once a patient can see these things, it really becomes clear why they would want to do therapy, why we want to focus on certain things rather than others.
Well, I think you're a real pioneer. And I wonder where you see your work going in the future.
Gosh, I have absolutely no idea. I look forward to being surprised by that myself.
Okay. Well, this is probably a good place for us to wrap it up. Do you have any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
You know, I think what I'd like to leave them with is a sense, hold your theories lightly and embrace your patients instead. Theory is a great way to guide us, but when any technique you're using doesn't seem to be working, let go of it. Feel free to try something different, because it's very important for us to be bracing the patient rather than a particular theoretical perspective. We hold on to it as long as it's useful, then we need to let go of it so we can relate more directly to the person who's in front of us.
Nice.
I think that's our eternal challenge as therapists.
Nicely said. Well, John Fredrickson, I want to thank you for being my guest again, this time on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I sure wish this book had been around when I was in graduate school trying to learn to be a psychotherapist. I don't think there was anything at that time close to being as explicit and practical as John Fredrickson's book. It's a much larger book than you might realize from the interview. We really only had time to scratch the surface. It's 529 pages in all, which is a hefty tome, but so worth it. It's strong not only theoretically, but also in terms of the rich how-to-do-it practical detail. And beyond this, I think it would be quite useful to therapists of any stripe, whether just starting out or experienced. As John pointed out in our interview, it's not doctrinaire, and it's adaptable to just about any theoretical perspective. I definitely see John's work as part of the future therapeutic consensus that I keep referring to. And he sees it that way too, which I find confirming and heartening. Finally, I need to add that he strikes me as a very fine and trustworthy human being as well. As always, I hope you will use the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar if you decide to buy his book. It's about $40 on Amazon, but a worthwhile investment for any therapist or counselor's bookshelf as a reference to be returned to from time to time.
Hi, Dave. My name is Dr. Michael O'Canna, and I am a medical director for an adolescent psychiatric unit up here in British Columbia. I've been listening to your podcast for about a week now, and in summary, I'm thrilled. You've collected interviews with some of the most exciting thinkers in neuroscience and mental health treatment today. I agree with the recent direction of your thinking. The age of Pax Medica is coming to a close, and a much more exciting era seems to be on the horizon. So I have decided to show my support, and I encourage all of your listeners to do the same. Just hit that support button and show Dave that you care. It feels good. Thanks, Dave, and I look forward to keeping up with your podcast.
Thanks so much for that endorsement, Dr. Michael O'Connor. It's been some time since he sent that to me, and so he's been listening for quite a bit longer than a week at this point, and he's been a very active listener, posting great comments in response to a number of the interviews. I encourage you to follow in his footsteps and make your own contribution to Shrink Wrap Radio if you have not already done so. As you may know, we have a strategic relationship with the Depth Psychology Alliance at DepthPsychologyAlliance.com, which is the brainchild of Bonnie Bright, a doctoral student who has created the go-to online portal for all things having to do with Jungian psychology and depth psychology in general. She's now producing a quarterly scholarly magazine there, as well as hosting book clubs and lots of very active discussions. I'm proud to announce that she has invited me to join her advisory board, along with some very distinguished Jungian analysts whom I have interviewed. If you don't have our podcast app, let me remind you that it's a good way to keep up with Shrink Wrap Radio. If you go to the apps tab on our site, you'll find all the information you need for getting either the iOS or the Android version for your smartphone or tablet. And it will put the 75 most recent episodes at your fingertips. Be sure to listen all the way to the end of today's episode so that you can hear a very psychological song composed and performed by Australian listener Louise Callanan. It's called Be in the Now.
Hi, this is Nancy Ferlotti, Jungian analyst and co-author of the book, The Dream and Its Amplification. And you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Nancy Ferlotti, who will be my return guest. More about that in a bit. First, let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. Here's one from champion transcriber Gloria Ullman, who writes in response to my interview with Mark Winburn on the archetypal roots of the blues. And she writes, "Hi, David. I know now why I resonate so strongly with you, apart from the interest in all things psychological. Like you, I grew up saturated with music, and I believe it helped my mother to survive what was a life of incredible hardship. I know it's been my saving grace. Mum was a great fan of blues, jazz, Negro spirituals, country, and Western pop, and anything but classical, which had no lyrics and therefore no story. Music was her religion, and although she wasn't overtly religious, the kind of music she loved was, at its core, religious. As you have said, some kind of religious conversion experience seems to be necessary for the kind of transformation of consciousness that allows one to let go of negative patterns. I think music is one of the most potent and ubiquitous carriers of the divine creative spirit, and is the kind of link to the good and the beautiful that we have such a hunger for. I can well identify with Gabor Mate's addiction to the acquisition of more music than he could possibly ever listen to. It was such a delight to hear you read out my comments on the interview with Dr. Mate, and I was thrilled to hear your comments afterwards. Listening to it being spoken by another voice was a very interesting experience in many ways. Regards, Gloria." Well, Gloria, you get to have that experience once again of hearing me read your letter and make some comments. And it's interesting that music played such a important role in your mother's life, and you say it really helped her to survive. I like your observation that we hunger for these, as you call it, ubiquitous carriers of the divine creative spirit. And I appreciate the fact that you remembered my comments about religious conversion and that I think it can be a key ingredient in transcending addiction. So keep listening and keep up the great transcription work anytime that you are so moved. Here's the next one, comes from Aaron. And Aaron writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Thank you for your rapid reply. I've heard so many thank you emails broadcast on your podcast mentioning how wonderfully prompt you are at responding to emails. With all that fills your schedule, it's very touching that you respond to each and every email that your listeners send to you within such a brief period of time. I see that the interview number 271, Happy, the movie with Rocco Bellick, has not been transcribed. I really enjoyed this interview, and after watching Happy, shared it with friends and family. It was a huge hit. I'd like to transcribe the interview. I must say that aside from work and creating time for myself and my family of friends and pets, I'm starting a prep for medical school, so it may take me a few sit-down sessions to finish the transcription. But if you're okay with it not being ready tomorrow, count me in. All the best." And that's from Aaron. Well, Aaron, I'm really glad that you're stepping forward to make a transcript of that interview, because the movie Happy had a huge impact on me and all of my friends as well. And so I think it's a really important one for us to have a transcript of, and hopefully it'll help students or other people who might need to read a quick transcript. But at the same time, it certainly wouldn't be a substitute for seeing the movie. So anybody who's hearing the sound of my voice right now, if you've not seen the movie Happy, I do believe it's available through Netflix. So if you're in an area where you can get Netflix, or you can find some other way to get hold of it, I really encourage you to do that. And finally, here's one from Andrea, who writes, "Hi, David. I have to say you have returned the shot in my arm with your personal email. I was and am very excited to have received your letter." Well, I was sending her thanks for a contribution that she made. She goes on to say, "I'm a visual artist and MFA student at UCR. I suspect UCR might be University of California at Redlands. I'm not sure. She goes on to say, and your program has provided countless hours of enriching knowledge that often feeds into my art. I listen while working in the studio. I'd be happy to create an audio, but as the shy person that I am, I'll need a few days to figure out exactly what I want to say. Thus, in time, I will send something. Thank you again for your amazing program. It's a thrill and honor to support it with the small means I have available. Sincerely, and again, that's from Andrea. Well, Andrea, I really look forward to your recording a little snippet to encourage other people to make a donation as you have done. I think it's great when it comes from someone other than myself to keep kind of harping on it. And you might think we'd be wealthy here by now, but we're not. It really doesn't add up to a whole lot. And yet it's really important, not just to help defray some of the expenses, but it always encourages me to keep going, even when I sometimes become tired or discouraged. So I really appreciate it. And I love the thought of that you are working in your art studio as you're listening to the shows and feeling enriched and inspired. What more could I want than that? So once again, we'll wrap it up with that. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to return guest Dr. John Fredrickson for sharing his secrets of effective dynamic therapy techniques. All you therapists out there, you're going to want to look at that book. Now, as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with return guest Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti, who will be talking about her new book, The Dream and Its Amplification. Be sure to keep listening after my All in Your Mind sign-off for Louise Callanan's original song, Be in the Now. So with that, until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
When I was just a young child, I felt so much pain. I had to leave my body again and again. But now I'm surrounded by friendship and love. So I'm calling my spirit down from above. I call my spirit back to my body. I give myself permission to be in the now. Be in the now. Be in the now. I give myself permission to be in the now. Generation after generation of people in been a suffering, and their suffering is mine. But with each day I'm learning, and as I learn I grow. And finally I'm feeling my body is my home. I call my spirit back to my body. I give myself permission to be in the now. yourself permission to be in the now.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.